Thank you, Cleves. Our final distinguished speaker this morning is Professor Grace Goodell. Professor Goodell is director of the Program on Social Change and Development at the Paul H. Nitze School of Advanced International Studies of Johns Hopkins University. A graduate of Wellesley College, she received her PhD in anthropology from Columbia University. Robert Nisbet was on her dissertation committee. She is the author of numerous publications and is presently writing a book on the moral dimensions of the East Asian capitalist model. As befits an anthropologist, she has conducted extensive research abroad, including Bolivia, Iran, and the Philippines. I suspect that she is the only person in this room who is fluent in both Persian and Tagalog. But not all of her fieldwork has taken her to faraway places. Since 1994, she has been director of the Empowering Neighborhood People Project, which teaches community self-reliance in inner-city neighborhoods of Washington, D.C. In doing so, it challenges what she calls the paternalism of Washington's inner-city culture. Some of you will recall that Professor Goodell was a guest speaker at the Philadelphia Society's 1993 regional meeting honoring Russell Kirk. Today, she will present remarks entitled Robert Nisbet, Civil Society, and Postmodernism's Constructed Order. It is a pleasure to welcome Professor Goodell back to the Society's platform.
Thank you very much, George, and I'd like to thank the Philadelphia Society for inviting me back here today. What I call the first Nisbetan law of society states that social life is distinct from the political order. Most of Bob Nisbet's work, in one way or another, contends against the perilous merging of these two. Social life is primordial, not, like political arrangements, constructed and continually reconstructed by human design. This central distinction between the social and the political has profound epistemological implications. Beginning with the family, the principal organizations that constitute social life have no other end than to be. In contrast, the political domain and the things that it ratifies are instrumental. Nisbetan social arrangements do not exist at the sufferance of any political authority. They do not require justification in terms of anything outside themselves. Historically and ontologically, they precede the political, especially the state. By the term political, Nisbet means governance that has been disembedded from its social matrix, desocialized. He generally equates politics with the public, which is also desocialized. The public, a uniquely modern Western phenomenon, comprises a universalist arena where all comers can understand all meaning and fully participate in everything. When the strong state, as it emerged in the West, tried to arrogate all important matters into its domain, the political became objectified, disembedded from social relations. Interpersonal morality lost its ability to channel or tame power. As a result, Western culture had to invent civil society in order to curb the misuse of power in what became the public domain. Therefore, the state and the public are two sides of the same coin. Note that the opposite of the public is not private. For example, most private corporations and foundations today are public in the sense that they are substantively determined by their participation in the public arena. Rather, the opposite of the public is that which will not let the universal penetrate, even to take a look. Note, too, that when we speak of civil society, civil refers to citizenship. It does not mean courteous or voluntary, but rather derives from civitas, the affairs of citizens with respect to the state. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the concept of civil society has become a major preoccupation of popular, political, and intellectual life in our country, almost the only element left of our common identity. The notion of civil society constitutes the ultimate reference point for most of our debates about domestic issues, for how we conduct these debates, for Supreme Court decisions about them, and for much of our foreign policy. Many of our churches see themselves primarily as actors in civil society, and moreover, as being internally organized as miniature civil societies. Many of our leading philanthropic foundations have become missionary engines for spreading civil society here and abroad. Conservatives talk and write about as much about civil society as liberals do. They like the term mediating structures. But that's just Nisbet's point about civil society. He would ask, mediating to what? There's nothing above or beyond his social structures to mediate to. They just are, in and of themselves. Nor is this preoccupation with civil society only American. Habermas, Gellner, and Havel, three of Europe's most prominent and interesting thinkers, have at times in recent years focused almost entirely on this topic. Bob Nisbet did not consider civil society the foundation of Western civilization. To the contrary, because he understood the link between the power of the modern state, the public arena's aggressiveness, the nature of civil society as being virtually synonymous with the public, and the politicization of social life, Nisbet directed our interest toward non-civil society. The opposition between it and civil society constitutes the generative principle of his work. He saw the central issue of our time to be that civil society does not protect the social, but rather co-opts and devours it. For him, the political order should only be one among many orders flourishing side by side. In his works, Nisbet traced how in the Renaissance, European political discourse began to bypass its profoundly textured non-political and non-public associational life, began to view plural centers of authority as dangerous to social cohesion, and began to believe that the messy society these comprised could only be held together by a single unlimited power. Plural centers of authority were dangerous to social cohesion. Still, if these ancient associations were to join and serve the polity, if they would become vital partners in political society, then their existence could be justified as long as they recognized the state's sovereignty. Civil society was born in this historic settlement, and politics, as well as the public, were its birthmates. In a recent issue of First Things, two scholars argue that homeschooling more effectively generates civic participation and fosters a higher civic value for democracy than public school education does. Because when compared to public school families, those who educate their children at home more often meet together at playgrounds, more frequently visit local museums and zoos, organize more drama productions and art workshops, enroll more children in YMCA swimming classes, and have more picnics. That picnics and art workshops manifest civic virtue would have appalled Nisbet, showing how far civil society has taken over. The arrangements of social interaction are not to be described or evaluated, not even their virtues, in terms of the polity. The social is sui generis, composed of family and friends, people, not citizens, just living out life, providing for their own continuity, not even necessarily improving the common good. These underlying assumptions of the First Things article reflect what Nisbet considered a seismic shift in Western society, all the more so in this case because they're naively summoned in defense of homeschooling. Nisbet traces this radical civil society shift to the revival of imperial Roman law in the late Middle Ages, which established three fatal innovations. First, the concept of state sovereignty, a concept that stands as an inevitable threat to the medieval kind of pluralism. The second important principle was Roman law's notable doctrine of formal legal concession, under which no group or association could claim to have legal reality except insofar as its existence and reality had been conceded by the sovereign. The third fatal principle emphasized by Roman law was that of contract, that no relationship among individuals can claim the sanction of the state unless it is shown to have been emanated from the willing consent of the actors. That is, that only deliberately constructed and contractually circumscribed associations are real. But weren't medieval corporations, the cornerstone of Nisbet's sociological thought, voluntary, contractual, instrumental, public, and political? And as such, aren't they the roots of the Western political participation? No, they were not. Our Whig historians have been blind to the crucial distinctions about them. None of those groups, artisan or merchant guilds, incorporated villages, communes, cities, or urban neighborhoods, charitable foundations, abbeys, not even militias or the university, none was based on contract. Nor was any set up to fulfill individuals' aggregated needs. Morally, rather than legally binding, these were brotherhoods constituted sacramentally, often with membership passing automatically from father to son. Though you could join some of them voluntarily, you could not specify a particular period of time after which you would be able to cut all ties clean and go on to something else. The models for all of them were the family and the church, not sustained by members' consent, not functioning at the pleasure of the Lord or the crown, and just as in the family and the church, never able to approve a member's exit when the arrangement no longer suited his needs or his interests. Though the corporations often clashed, they did so in a multi-central field of authority, not remotely resembling modern interest groups. Nor were they understood to have received their freedom from the state. Even those deliberately established, such as new monastic communities, guilds, or daughter communes, made a point of tracing kinship-like descent from an ancient foundation. Medieval culture did not consider the corporations that made up society to be contrivances of human artifice, humanly devised. They were natural and timeless, as objectively real as mountains and the sun. This core attribute of Nisbetan social order, its objective reality, is of utmost epistemological, indeed ontological, importance in considering the relevance of Nisbet's work to our times. Sovereignty, legal concession, and contract, for him the fatal triad, made social organizations politically contingent, whereas those that constitute the Nisbetan order are not constructed and therefore not liable to political or legal deconstruction. Just as the objective reality of the sun lies largely in the fact that humans could never have made it, nor could we deconstruct it if we wished, for the same reasons the family, the church, and other Nisbetan social structures are real, including society itself. In a Nisbetan world, the primary social structures are simply out there, existing like the Alps or Jupiter, the result of no human design. In short, realist epistemology hinges on the first Nisbetan law of society, that social structures are sui generis, owing their existence to nothing man-made. If such an order is to be taken as real, it cannot belong to civil society. If we encourage the postmodernists to enter into partnership with Bob Nisbet, together they articulate the second law, Nisbetan law of society, namely that where there are no realist social forms, where all life is carried on in the public arena, there will also be no social meaning. Postmodernism describes the semantic apogee of civil society, associations, events, inclinations, ideas, anything, moments, literally, contacts, flow and intersect, join and then unjoin in a field of freedom, in a bath of freedom. All crusty old Nisbetan structures, bounded as discrete units against willful dissolution or recreation, have been laid bare in civil society's transparency. They are open to strangers, the public, for construction and deconstruction whenever and whatever one wishes. The Nisbetan objection to contract is that a social world established on agreement between individual wills is, in all its freedom and glory, humanly contrived. The more the social foundations are what free people make of them, the more they need the rule of law. And the more rule of law rules, the more everything is illusion. In civil society's supremely purposive, law-protected world, Freedom, individualism, and choice do indeed abound. But when they depend on legal contract, they become likely enemies of social meaning. Foucault shows us the connection between the power of law and the Benthamite state, the unmasking of Nisbetan realism, and the disappearance of social meaning. Foucault's postmodernism gives us a skillfully drawn ethnography of our own post-Nisbetan world. What then is it like to live in a world where reality is, as Peter Berger says, constructed, and where picnics, art shows, and kids' swimming classes win gold medals for making good citizens? One salient consequence, when universalized meaning replaces socially shared meaning, is that the only things intelligible in the public arena are facts. In civil society, facts provide the life-giving common currency. Since facts cannot even touch upon life's significant matters, meaning becomes trivialized. The state's domination becomes easy to bear because it too is petty. This is not the fault of the media or of economists who like numbers. It is the concomitant of a man-made order. Sovereignty seeks shallow meaning because shallow meaning is uniform, and uniformity makes governance simpler and fairer. England is said to be the fount of the rule of law, and Burke discovered the sovereign's demand for homogeneity in the British rule of Ireland, India, and America. Now, to infuse order into a semantic field of mere facts requires an ideology to select which facts to use and to hold them together coherently. Civil society arranges its facts within doctrinal systems that politicize them and do so in simple enough terms so that the public can organize civil society groups in support of one doctrinal system or in opposition to another. In his highly acclaimed study of Italy, Putnam praises as vital civil society institutions soccer leagues created by the Communist Party. Not surprisingly, he condemns Southern Italy's familism because it rebuffs democracy's temptation, and its structures inure themselves against the state's penetration. In the twilight of authority, everyone is a sandbox citizen. If you don't get into the act and create your own polity, someone else will create it for you. In this politicized public, the state must operate at the individual's level of desocialized self-interest. Tocqueville observed that in all civil society, politics are transformed into economics, well-being, because unlike traditional politics, economics accepts the individual as its basic operative unit. Thus, after trivializing all matters of weight, civil society's political discourse ultimately boils down to the lone individual's impulses and desires. The relativists are right. Man-made social forms have no foundation, no grounding in justice or truth. Not ethics, not politics, not even law can utter censure, because post-Nisbetan society has no moral or even perceptual tools for judging another person or even for judging oneself. Contrast Bill's recent impeachment trial, played out in the opinion polls, with Henry IV's humiliation, repentance, and fear of excommunication as he, the Holy Roman Emperor, knelt barefoot for 3 days in the snow. Nisbetan political drama fresh in the mind of Bismarck 800 years later. In contrast to civil society's bric-a-brac politics and ethics, in a Nisbetan order, stable social groups wrangle and clash with one another, each with its textured deposits of shared meanings that have accrued over time and merge into the ontological reality of creation itself. The group that cannot be deconstructed comprises the basic operative unit, a unit of impenetrable intricacy whose social density is matched by its irreducible semantic complexity. The stuff of such political discourse and conflict comprises multi-layered references and connotations that only insiders can fully grasp. Lessons from the unfathomable particulars of history, sanctions that reorder a person's being like public shame, tough considerations about the nature of man, of sin and power. Transparency, another of civil society's ideals, forbids symbolic language and ritual, the Nisbetan order's vessels of truth. Transparency abhors secrets, but by its very nature, the Nisbetan order has origins shrouded in mystery. Neither its structures nor their business can be made transparent, that is, encompassed by the human intellect. The ultimate definition of privacy is that you cannot penetrate our shared meanings, our affairs. To civil society, such thick culture is subversive because it prevents the state and the public from direct access to the individual. Civil society's shallow meanings and transparent social structures make postmodernism, a form of nominalism, the only reasonable position to explain experience in our world. When formal law constructs and defines marriage, it makes sense that whichever two people live together, or even if they do not live together, they can call themselves a marriage, no different from a man and woman joined sacramentally in eternal union. Everyone should just use the legal economic term contract. After all, we're just talking about terms. Foucault is correct. In a world void of substantial social distinctions, there is no big picture, no rock. Union requires profound contrast. I've emphasized the epistemological differences between civil society and a Nisbetan order, not only because the postmodernist question is a crucial one, is there any social meaning left in our society, but also because the Nisbetan order of plural central centers of authority cannot be understood apart from the singularity of truth at the foundation of society. Nisbet shows us that the objective reality, the objectivity of social structures is part and parcel of realism, and vice versa. People in a Nisbetan world believed in the objective reality of things around them and of invisible things like God because they lived in a non-contrived social forms. Their social landscape was made up of self-governing and self-justifying structures whose authority did not derive from civil society with its constructed laws. Their social forms required no reference point in the political order, no concessions from the state. When social forms have real substance, then God can be real. How can we graft onto the nominalist social order in which we live a realist epistemology with its foundational truth? Social realism and epistemological realism are inseparable, and according to Nisbet, the first prepares the way for the second. The breakup of social meaning is a consequence of the breakup of real social forms.